I have one more thing to do before we wrap up the period of the Reformation. And that is, I want to discuss men of the period. And what I have in mind is that we talk about Erasmus, Philip Melanchthon, Beza, John Knox, and Arminius. So if you knew those men, you would know the highlight, the figures, the most prominent figures of this period. So let's start with Erasmus. I'm going to talk about, in each of these, just a brief word about their life, and then I want to talk about their works. Usually they wrote something. And then, in most of these cases, I want to talk about their significance. So, we're going to start with Erasmus. His dates are 1466 to 1536. He was born in Holland. He was the illegitimate son of a priest and a doctor's daughter, a fact that depressed him all of his life. In that day, you can imagine what a blight that was. Today, that wouldn't be near as an issue. He attended school of the Brethren of the Common Life. The Brethren of the Common Life existed to promote piety, to provide education for boys in need, and to encourage good works in general. One of their students was Thomas a Kempis, who wrote The Imitation of Christ. So that'll show you the emphasis was not theological, it was more practical and pietistic. Erasmus became a monk and was ordained as a priest. He left the monastery, and because he felt it was unsuited for the life of a monk, he studied at many of the universities in Europe and England. During his lifetime, he lived in Paris, England, Switzerland, Italy, but his home was mainly in Basel in Switzerland. He became a best-selling author. So that leads me to say something about his works. In 1503, using the military metaphor of the Christian life, he wrote The Handbook of the Christian Soldier. With sarcasm, he pointed out the evils of the life of the priestly and the monastic hierarchy in two books, The Praise of Folly and Familiar Colloquialism. So he wrote some of those kinds of popular books. His most important contribution to the history of the church was his printed edition of the New Testament. Now, prior to the printing press, all we had were handwritten manuscripts of the scripture. Obviously, there was no printing press. Somewhere around 1450, Gutenberg invented the printing press, and they printed the Gutenberg Bible. They printed the Hebrew Bible. But by 1514, nobody had ever printed the Greek text. There were some Catholic priests who were about to do that, and a printer went to Erasmus and said, "Would you put something together so we could get to press and print the first Greek New Testament?" So in his travels around Europe, he found manuscripts of the New Testament and edited those manuscripts and produced the first printed Greek New Testament. He wanted to reach the market with the printed New Testament before those other guys. That was the whole point. And the printer did, and so he urged Erasmus to provide one. Some say he only used four manuscripts. Others say it was six. But he used what he could get his hands on. Now, there were some fallacies in his work. The last four verses of the book of Revelation were missing from the manuscripts he had. So he went to the Latin, translated it into Greek, and that became his Greek New Testament, for which he's been severely criticized. You know the verse that says in 1 John, there are three in heaven? That verse wasn't in any of the manuscripts, and so some priests objected. And he said, tongue in cheek, you find me a manuscript with it, and I'll put it in the next edition. And they did. And he thought they made it up just for his benefit, but he promised he'd put it in, so he'd put it in. So that got put in his edition. The second edition, the first one came out in 1516. Between 1516 and 1535, he published five editions. He kept revising as he found manuscripts. They were very minor. The second edition was 1519, and it's the one Martin Luther used to translate the Bible into German. Now, I've written an article on this. It's on the internet, called The Translation of the Bible, and I go into a lot of detail that I don't plan to do here. But this is a significant issue. Just to round out that story, some people came after him. Stephanus put in the verse divisions. Beza edited the thing, and that went through editions. It ultimately became the Greek text on which the King James Version was translated. That's 1611. In 1633, a publisher was going to publish this text that had been revised now numerous times by several different men. And in the preface, he said, this is, using Latin, the Textus Receptus, Latin for the received text. Everybody accepts this text. So the text was called the Textus Receptus. That was way after Erasmus, way after Stephanus and Beza, and the King James translation. So later it was given the name Textus Receptus. In 1524, in response to Luther's teaching on the free will, Erasmus wrote Discourse on the Free Will. He believed in free will. Luther answered by writing Bondage of the Will. Now, that is one of the most well-known works in all of church history. Clearly, one of Luther's greatest contributions. And it was because he was answering Erasmus. So Erasmus is critical for the New Testament, Greek New Testament, printed edition, and reacting to Luther and Luther responding with Bondage of the Will. By the way, this whole thing becomes the great debate in all of church history. Does man have free will or doesn't he? That's the issue in philosophy. How much free will do we have? It's the issue in theology, and it's the issue in psychology. There are schools of thought that teach you're a product of your past. Sigmund Freud, who started modern psychotherapy, was a determinist. Everything you do in adult life was determined because of the Oedipus complex when you were 5 years old and you wanted to go to bed with your mother and kill your father. It's determinism. It's no free will. It's all determined. Now, there are people in the psychology field that would object to what I just said, but my point is that you get down to behaviorism, and they're clearly saying you're a product of your environment, period. Pure behaviorists don't even believe there's such a thing as a mind. You're just responding to your environment. So this is the great debate in philosophy, theology, and even psychology. So it started with Arius. Remember him? He said, if God commanded it, you should be able to do it. Who rebutted him? You forgot? Augustine. I'm sorry, that was Aramaeus.
Okay, not Aramaeus. That makes more sense.
Aramaeus rebutted him. The next guy to come along was Pelagius. And who rebutted him? Augustine. So this, my point is, this just goes way back into church history. The Erasmus-Luther debate began with something Luther wrote in response to the papal bull against him. Luther wrote an article condemning as heretical 42 of the papal propositions. In Article 36, Luther said free will was a fiction. And that is what Erasmus responded to. And what Erasmus wrote is what Luther responded to produce bondage of the will. So, Erasmus, in his book Discourse on Free Will, defines the free will as, quote, the power of the human will, whereby man can supply to or turn away from that which leads him into eternal salvation. So that becomes the great debate. Erasmus argues that as a result of the fall, man's will had been weakened, not destroyed, but it is incapable of eternal salvation unless grace brings him to faith. So if all of that sounds confusing to you, welcome to the fold. That's what the theologians debate to make a living. All right. Erasmus opposed Lutheran's view that all good deeds are detestable in God's sight. They're detestable as adultery and murder. By the way, this is one of those things that I read Bondage of the Will. And Luther clearly teaches that an unsaved person cannot do anything that's good. Now, if you mean by that anything that good that God accepts and is going to contribute to your salvation, I agree. But the way he writes, man, it sounds like, well, Erasmus said, it's as bad as murder and adultery. I think that's going a little far. Jesus said, if you know how to give good gifts, then certainly the Father in heaven would, you know. So, anyway, you need to know about Erasmus because of the whole thing of his New Testament and his debate with Luther. And I can go on and on and on about this. Let me just give you a sample. To prove free will, he cites Ecclesiastes 15, 14 through 18, Genesis 4, 6 and 7, Deuteronomy 30, 15 through 19, Isaiah 1, 19, 21, 12, 45, 20, 45, 22, 52, 1 to 2, Zechariah 1, 3, Ezekiel 18, 21, 18, 24, 18, 31, 33, 11, Joel 22, 12, Jonah 3, 8, Isaiah 46, 8, Jeremiah 26, 3 through 4, Exodus 32, 9, Micah 6, 3, Ezekiel 20, 13, Psalm 80, 14, Psalm 33, 13 through 14, Deuteronomy 30, 11 through 14. And those are just in the Old Testament. So, he went at it. After citing scripture, both Old Testament and New Testament, he addresses two arguments against free will. The first is the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. He appeals to Origen's solution that God hardens those who reject his mercy, his offer of mercy, so Pharaoh had free will to reject, and so God hardened his heart. He answers Luther's arguments against free will, usually by simply pointing out the passages that Luther quotes are not denying free will, or they have nothing to do with eternal salvation. So that is quite the little debate. And you need to at least know who Erasmus is and what he was up to. Now, I've got all kinds of stuff on all this, but I think you've got the gist of it. So I'm going to keep moving. One author concludes, to do justice to the situation, we must be content with a paradox, affirming both divine predestination and human responsibility. Which is not to say that both Erasmus and Reuther had won, or that both shall have prizes, for it is commits to us neither to Luther's overconfident statements about predestination, nor Luther's much-to-be-naive view of free will. What is meant is that we are willing to recognize the limits of our own understanding and to believe that things beyond our comprehension and make perfectly good sense to God. And that's my view. I think God sovereignly elects, and I think man has free will. And I don't understand that. Great is the mystery of godliness. Deuteronomy 29:29. Mystery belongs to the Lord. Now, one quick word. How many gods are there? One? Don't you believe in the Trinity?
But there's one.
That's one plus one plus one equals one. Explain that to me. I believe Jesus was 100% God. I believe Jesus was 100% man. Theologians call that the hypostatic union. Mathematically, that's 200%. I don't get it. Or, who wrote Romans? I thought the Holy Spirit wrote it. That's my position. All right, I want to talk about Erasmus' significance for a minute. He's been called the forerunner of the Reformation. In fact, it has been said that he made the Reformation almost inevitable. The monks of the time said that Erasmus laid the egg which Luther hatched. Now that's how significant he is. Actually, Erasmus was not a reformer himself. He was a monk. He loved peace so much that he would sacrifice a part of truth rather than cause dissension. Luther said of him, quote, he points out the evil, but he's unable to point out the good that leads to the promised land, end of quote. He promoted the Reformation by exposing the abuses of the church in his writings and by editing the first Greek New Testament. He did as much as anybody in preparing for the Reformation, but he did not join the movement. He remained a Catholic and a critic of the Reformation. Wow. To be more specific, Erasmus received the pomp and quite rejected the pomp and quest for earthly glories that characterized Roman Catholicism of his day. He spoke against the monks and monasteries, which had become havens of idleness, ignorance, and iniquity. He held to such orthodox doctrines as the Trinity and the Incarnation, but he insisted that obedience was more important than orthodoxy. He attacked friars who were capable of subtle theological discussions, but whose lives were scandalous. For example, he said, what good is it to be outwardly sprinkled with the holy water if one is filthy inside? No wonder it would be said that he laid the egg and Luther hatched it. So, Erasmus is a very significant figure in church history. If for no other reason, he edited the first Greek New Testament that became the standard work until 1881, when Westcott and Hort printed the Westcott and Hort edition of the New Testament. So, he was the forerunner of the Reformation, he edited the first Greek New Testament, and really got into a heated debate with Luther over free will. The second person I would like to discuss is Philip Melanchthon. First of all, I want to talk a little about his life. Philip Melanchthon entered the University of Heidelberg when he was 12 years old. By the way, his dates are 1497 to 1560. In 1511, at the age of 14, he received a BA degree. In 1512, when he applied to take the examination for the MA degree, the professors refused to allow him to continue because they thought a 15-year-old could not possibly be accepted as a teacher. He finished his studies, and in 1514, he received an MA at another university. He received the MA at age 17. Can you imagine? A BA at 14 and an MA at 17. He began teaching and writing, which he was to continue to do until the day he died. He was influenced by, guess who? Erasmus. At age 21, he was already a well-trained in classic languages and in Hebrew. He taught French in several places, and ending up at Wittenberg. Who was at Wittenberg?
Luther.
So, he met Luther in 1518. Remember, Luther tacked up the 95 Theses in 1517. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, a year later, he meets Melanchthon. The relationship with Luther changed him from being a humanist to a theologian and a reformer. So you would call Erasmus a humanist because of his emphasis on free will. So he was influenced by Erasmus, but he met Luther. In 1529, at Marburg, he opposed Zwingli, who believed the Lord's table was a memorial. So he rejected that. Melanchthon insisted that it was more than a memorial. During the time with Calvin was during the time Calvin was living in Strasbourg, he met Melanchthon at a conference in Frankfurt in 1539. They struck up a friendship that lasted to Luther's death. Now, I don't know why Luther's death changed it, but apparently it did. I want to talk about his works. In 1518, at the age of 16, he published a Greek grammar. which was the first book to clearly describe the teaching of the Reformation. I'm sorry. I skipped a line. In 1521, he wrote a short work entitled Commonplaces, which was the first work to clearly describe the teachings of the Reformation. In it, Melanchthon rejected the authority of the Roman Church, the Fathers, canon law, the Scholastics. He made the Bible the final authority for Christians, taught that men were bound by sin, unable to help himself, and insisted that God must initiate the work of salvation and that individuals receive faith, that individuals received by faith are received by faith in Christ. This work established Melanchthon as the theologian of the Lutheran movement. Now that's what you write down. Melanchthon was the theologian of Lutheranism, not Martin Luther. Luther called Melanchthon's work immortal. During his lifetime, it went through 50 editions and he also contributed to Luther's German translation of the Bible. In fact, he gave it a thorough revision. In 1513, he wrote the Augsburg Confession, which remains the chief statement of faith in the Lutheran Church till this day. So you got to know Melanchthon. So let me talk a bit about his theology. Then I'll talk about his significance. By and large, Melanchthon agreed with Luther's doctrinal position. But there were two differences. Melanchthon, who had never agreed with Luther's assertion about the enslaved will, was also indeed moving to a position that granted that sinful human beings with greater freedom, and eventually came to speak of a collaboration between the spirit, the word, and the human will. All right. Remember, he was influenced by Erasmus? He never quite bought bondage of the will, like Luther taught it. But eventually came to say there was some kind of collaboration. So that's not corpse in the casket. Man can cooperate at some point. J.I. Packer, who is a staunch Calvinist, said, quote, Melanchthon describes himself to fallen, ascribes to fallen man free will in the sense of power of applying oneself to grace. This phrase from Erasmus, which Luther had abhorred, Melanchthon explicitly approved. That's J.I. Packer. Melanchthon affirmed Luther's doctrine of justification by faith, but insisted on the need for good works, not as a means of salvation, but as a result of salvation. So, he basically was Lutheran, but his theology differed on that one little question of free will. Let me talk about his significance. Melanchthon was Luther's right-hand man and the first theologian of the Reformation. When Martin Luther died, Melanchthon took over as the theological leadership of the movement that Luther had begun. With his gift for logic and wide knowledge of history, his influence on Protestantism was in certain ways even greater than Luther's was. That's quite a startling statement. Luther owed much to the calmness, gentleness, and wise counsel of Melanchthon, who did his best to keep the reformer's zeal and fervency within proper bounds. So Melanchthon was very close to Luther and kept him in check because he could be passionate. For the sake of peace, Melanchthon was willing to concede the matter of doctrine to the Roman Catholics. In fact, he believed reunion with Catholicism was essential. It is said that the sad story of Melanchthon's life is the story of the interim. After Luther's death on May 1548, Emperor Charles V invaded Germany and tried to force the people to sign the Augsburg Interim, which was to settle the controversy between the Roman Church and the evangelicals during the interim period until a church council could be held. The Lutherans refused to sign, In November of 1548, Melanchthon and others from Wittenberg revised it and Melanchthon was criticized for compromising Luther's positions. So, he's the theologian, but he didn't walk in lockstep with Luther. The Augsburg Interim ordered the Protestants to adopt Catholic beliefs and practices, including the seven sacraments, but it allowed the Protestant clergymen the right to marry. Can you imagine Luther's right-hand man signing a document saying we're going to observe the seven sacraments? He allowed the laity to receive both bread and wine in the communion. In his revised edition, it made a distinction between essential doctrines, such as justification by faith, and the non-essential doctrines, such as confirmation and the use of candles, mass, and holy days. So he thought reunion was essential and he compromised. There's also the fascinating story of Prince Philip, who was a sincere man committed to the Protestant cause, who was deeply troubled for years because he had no marital relationships with his wife and found it impossible to remain celibate. So, plagued with guilt from his illicit affairs, he consulted with Protestant theologians, Luther, Melanchthon, and Brucer, about the possibility of taking a second wife without putting away his first wife. All three agreed that the Bible did not forbid polygamy. They said, however, that although polygamy was not a crime in the eyes of God, it was such in the eyes of civil law. Therefore, they recommended that he take the second wife in secret, which is what he did. When the secret became public, needless to say, there was a great deal of scandal. Many years ago, a seminary professor said to me in a private conversation, "Mike, all men have feet of clay." And in my lifetime, I have concluded all men have feet of clay. Can you imagine Martin Luther recommending the guy take a wife, but do it secretly? And of course, there's the case of, I didn't go into, John Calvin participating in somebody that believed in baptism, take him down and let him drown him. That gets debated, but there's all kinds of... The only perfect one is Jesus. Peter denied the Lord. Moving right along, I want to go back and talk about Beza for a second. There are things about Beza that we should note. Let me talk about his life. His dates are 1519 to 1605. He was trained as a lawyer. He wrote a book of love poems which gained him the reputation of a Latin poet. In 1544, he secretly married a woman. They did not have any children. In 1548, he went to Geneva where he announced that he had become a Protestant and was appointed professor of Greek at the University of Lausanne. From 1549 to 1559, he was a Greek professor. In 1559, he became the first rector of the Geneva Academy that Calvin started. And when Calvin died, he became the leader in Geneva. Now let's talk about his works. He edited several editions of the Greek New Testament. I referred to this a minute ago, which became the basis for the Geneva Bible and ultimately for the King James Version. He completed the translation of the Psalms begun in the French by a French poet, and wrote a biography of Calvin, as well as political and polemical and theological tracts. Let me talk about his theology. And I've done this to some degree. As I stated earlier, predestination was the centerpiece of his theology. What was not mentioned was that his biblical justification for doing that. He said Paul's question in Romans 9:21, does not the potter have power over the clay from the same lump to make one sacred and one vessel to honor and the other to dishonor? Remember that verse? That is the cornerstone of Beza's theology. So he says that verse indicates that God decreed that some would be saved and some would be damned before human beings were created. This became known as superlapsarianism. Now, I told you about superlapsarianism. What I did not tell you is there's two other positions. There's infralapsarianism, and there is sublapsarianism. So, let me just briefly describe these. Okay. Those terms were not used until shortly after the Synod of Dort. The word lapsus is a Latin word for fall. Thus, the sense, the issue is, within the theological decree of God, what happened before the fall, and in the decree, what happened after the fall? Supra-lapsarianism. Supra comes from the Latin above, before, is the doctrine that God decreed the election of some and the damnation of others before he decreed the fall. That position produces double predestination. And that's Beza. Infralapsarian. Infra comes from the Latin word which means below or after the fall. In this view, in the decree of the fall, God decreed that the election of some and the damnation of others. Those who hold to the infralapsarian view say God was passive in double predestination. He did not actively choose people to be damned. He actively chose some to salvation, but he simply passed by others, and those are the ones that end up damned. Sublapsarianism. Sub comes from the Latin word, another Latin word for below. Is the theory that God decreed the fall and the atonement for all. He decreed the election of some and the damnation of others. This is the position of unlimited atonement. So, Beza is the one that started all of that. His significance. He succeeded Calvin in Geneva as leader of the Reformation. He was one of the leading advisors to the Huguenots in France, even participating in their conferences. His theological method made the Reformed position more rigid. Under his leadership, Geneva became the center of the Protestant Reformation. So he is deeply, deeply, deeply significant. All right, let me talk about one more. Let me talk about John Knox, and then maybe we'll take a quick break. John Knox's dates are 1514 to 1572. He was educated for the priesthood at St. Andrew's University in Scotland and was ordained in 1536. Instead of entering the pastorate, he became a tutor. There is no record of when he was converted to Protestantism. In 1547, Knox was taken prisoner by the French and forced to serve as a galley slave. His captivity lasted for 19 months. After his release, he went to England, where he became a pastor. Edward VI was king at the time. When Mary came to the throne, now, you remember Henry VIII had all these children, and one was Edward and one was Mary. When Mary came to the throne, she instituted Catholicism. Remember that? Knox fled to Germany and Switzerland. He spent 4 years in Germany, where John Calvin was preaching. He adopted Calvin's view of doctrine and church government. Excuse me. To him, Calvin was the noble servant of God. He also spent some time in Zurich, and Bullinger, Zwingli's successor, was there. In 1559, he returned to Scotland, and later, with local adjustments, he organized the Reformed Church in Scotland according to the pattern after Geneva. He died in 1572. As his body was lowered in the grave, Martin, the regent of Scotland, pointed to him and said, "There was a man who never feared a man." Let's talk about his works. Knox consolidated the Reformation in Scotland by drawing up its Confession of Faith, a book of discipline, and a new liturgy, the Book of Common Order, and translating Calvin's catechism. He wrote a book against Mary, the Tudor Queen of England, entitled First Blast Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. Boy, you'd never get away with printing a book like that today. In it, he argued that contrary to nature, God, and God's word, it was to have a woman ruler. Soon after it circulated in England, Mary died, and she was succeeded by Elizabeth I, who resented much of what Knox had written. None of Knox's repeated retractions satisfied her. Incidentally, Calvin dedicated his revised edition of his commentary on Isaiah to Queen Elizabeth. Is history interesting or what? I've often said, who needs soap operas?
Yeah.
His significance. John Knox gave Scotland a body of Protestant doctrine and a pattern of worship that endures to this day. He was able to make the Presbyterian faith and order supreme in Scotland, and to direct the reforms more radical than any other land of Europe. Now, the reason I even brought him up is Calvin in Geneva ends up starting a church that we don't hear very much about, but it still exists today, called the Reformed Church of America.
the Reformed Church. Knox took Calvinism, meaning his church doctrine, church polity, to Scotland, and that produced Presbyterianism. So John Knox is the virtual founder of Presbyterianism, which is historically not a lot of difference between the Reformed Church. Now, in subsequent times, they each tweaked their position. Some Presbyterian churches are actually liberal. Princeton Seminary is the Presbyterian seminary, and it's very liberal. But historically, there isn't a lot of difference between the Reformed Church and the Presbyterian Church, except geography. One's Geneva, one's Calvin, the other is Scotland and Presbyterian. Episcopal came out of England. Baptist virtually came out of England as well.
I don't mean to take too much time on this, but what kind of defines an Episcopal church? You know, Presbyterian is their government, and Baptist is the fact that they don't baptize babies.
You mean just the government part?
What's the hallmark of what Episcopal means for the church? Like, why do they assign to that?
Okay. You want to know about the Episcopal Church?
Yes. What is the biggest
difference? All right.
Biggest difference.
All right. The Episcopal Church, put it on a ship and bring across the Atlantic Ocean, and you've got in England, it's the Anglican Church or the Church of England. You put it on a boat and it comes over here and it's the Episcopal Church. Same thing as the Church of England, except it's its own organization. Now, because of the history of the Anglican Church, remember Edward, Mary, Elizabeth. Elizabeth finally settled it all down. Remember, they went from Protestant to Catholic to Protestant. No. Episcopalianism in America is considered the denominational big tent. That you could be, because of its roots in Anglicanism, there is a movement in the Anglican Church and the Episcopal Church that's high church. It's close to Catholicism. It also is the big tent in that it includes evangelicals. So that I know a man that is an Anglican in America, and he's studying to become a priest in the Anglican Church. And he's evangelical, believes in justification by faith. But he's very committed to the Anglican form of worship, which is liturgy. So the big difference, but you ask about government. The Anglican Church and the Episcopal Church is ruled by a bishop who appoints the rector of the church. We'd say pastor. Whereas the Baptists are independent. Each church governs itself and calls the pastor. And there's no in Baptist doctrine, there is no authority over the local church, political or ecclesiastical. In the Catholic Church, it's the bishop. In the Anglican Church, it's the bishop. In the Episcopal Church, it's the bishop. In the Presbyterian Church, it's the presbytery, a group. In Congregational, Baptist, Pentecostal, it's congregational government. Did that come out right?
Yeah.
Crash course in ecclesiology. Let's take a break.